This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Brian Ballow is a Mayo Distinguished Teaching Professor of History at the University of Virginia, and he is co-chair of the Governing America in a Global Era program at UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. You'll also recognize his voice as one of the hosts of Backstory. He's one of the history guys on National Public Radio, produced right here in Charlottesville at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, online at backstory.org. Brian Ballow joins us live in studio. How are you, sir? It's good to see you again.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Coy.
Let's start with the good news about Backstory. What's the latest?
Well, Backstory, which is on backstoryradio.org, the selection yesterday, the staff favorite on the iTunes store for all downloaded podcasts.
That's a very big deal at iTunes. Yeah,
we're very excited. I tried to explain it to my wife as kind of like getting on the front page of the New York Times, and not for being indicted either.
No, it's a good thing. Now, how do you explain the program to people, for those who haven't heard it yet?
Well, my producers hate this, but I like to say it's kind of car talk for history. It's built around calling, just like you have to take calls sometimes.
Sure, yeah.
INA runs a lot of call-in shows, so it's built around that. But we also, there are three of us. I'm 20th century history guy, and Ed Ayers is 19th century history guy. Ed's president of the University of Richmond, but was a real stalwart here at the University of Virginia for decades.
Of course, yeah.
And my colleague at the UVA History Department, Peter Onuf, is 18th century guy. But, you know, both Peter and I, we poach on that 19th century a lot. Ed's got to defend his turf. And so we interview other scholars who have written interesting books. But what I like doing the most, and I get to do a lot as 20th century guy, I get to interview live people. So we were talking about federalism, and I got to interview a woman who's a truck driver, and she had a very different view of states than the chair of the Governors Association.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I got to interview Roger Staubach. We were doing a show about Thanksgiving, and I actually didn't want to do it, and guy said, yeah, we're going to do it. I said, all right, I demand to interview Roger Staubach or somebody else on the Dallas Cowboys because, hey, who plays football every Thanksgiving?
Right.
It's either the Detroit Lions or the Dallas Cowboys. And frankly, I couldn't think of anybody that people would know on the Detroit Lions.
So, yeah, yeah.
I've just offended all those Lions fans out there. all three of them.
You're old enough to remember the day when it was always the Dallas Cowboys and the Pittsburgh Steelers.
No, it was the Lions and the Cowboys. They used to play each other.
Okay.
Yeah, and originally it was just the Lions. They started in the 30s. And, you know, the Cowboys started this because they wanted to expand coverage. They wanted a second game. They wanted to have a late game. And the only person who would do it was the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, Staubach. And he explained that. So you can learn a lot of history from Roger Staubach.
There you go. Brian Ballow is with the University of Virginia. You can check out the Backstory program online at backstoryradio.org. Brian's most recent book is A Government Out of Sight, The Mystery of National Authority in 19th Century America, which we discussed in detail the last time you were in studio. But to sort of kickstart this conversation we'll have today, sort of recap your book for us share the central thesis with us.
Sure. I argue that although most Americans think that the federal government, the national government, did very little during the 19th century, in fact, it was a very important part of people's lives. It tended to do things that weren't terribly visible. So it subsidized things. For instance, it subsidized the delivery of the mail. And that was very important because people got their news and their newspapers through the mail. So I argue in the book that the post office was the CNN of its day, and it was able to do that because of government subsidies. Of course, it could appear more forcefully when groups or individuals got in the way of government expansion. We think of that westward expansion as happening kind of naturally or through the courage of individual pioneers, and it certainly did take courage to move out west. But it also took roads, it took canals subsidized by the national government, and most of all, it took security. The army protected settlers as they moved west, and most importantly, it cleared Indians when Indians began to interfere with the westward expansion of American settlers.
And there really was no private enterprise in place at that time that could have done all those things that the federal government did, was there?
Well, certainly there were land speculators who came in and bought and sold private land, but no, there was no way that the private sector or even states and localities could operate on such a wide plane in order to ensure territorial integrity, in order to make sure that trade kept flowing. So the title, A Government Out of Sight, refers to things like the power of treaty making. You know, if we didn't keep trade running down the Mississippi River in the first third of the 19th century, a lot of those good red-blooded Americans that we love to honor today, they would have been French or Spanish if it meant getting their trade down the river. And that's just the fact of the matter. So diplomacy, creating those treaties was very important. And my argument is that Americans have always turned to the national government. However, they have been wary of centralized bureaucracy located in Washington, D.C., you know, running things directly. Instead, the national government has distributed its authority clearly through states and localities, but through a lot of private companies. You know, the way the mail got delivered was often through private contractors. And those same contractors, they ran the stagecoaches. That was our transportation system. But a third of the revenue that they got was from the federal government. And we wouldn't have had all those stagecoaches. We wouldn't have had operations like the Pony Express, a kind of classic example of private enterprise. That was kind of a put-up job. That was really a sales pitch to get the contract to deliver the news to the West, which ultimately was subsidized at one-third by the federal government. So I like to say that the private sector was eating at least a third of its food at the public trough, even back in the early 19th century.
We're talking with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. And, of course, that flies in the face of what most people have been led to believe, that this whole idea of big government is sort of a 20th century invention.
Right. And I try to avoid the term big government in any century of American history. And what my book does focus on, and what we can talk about a little bit today, even as we move into the 20th and the 21st century, is the way Americans govern. And my argument is Americans have always turned to the national government to be an important piece of governance, an important piece of keeping the peace, of creating a national market, of having an economy that will provide jobs and sound opportunities for Americans. Americans have always turned to the national government, but they have not wanted a kind of Soviet-style central command economy. It is true that they have avoided that. And by talking about the way we govern, Coy, I think we can shift the conversation from, oh, Democrats want big government, Republicans want small government, to, I think, a more intelligent conversation about the kind of government that Americans want, acknowledging that they've always turned to the national government for some things, but also acknowledging, and this is where I get in trouble with my progressive friends, also acknowledging that the government has often subsidized churches, subsidized voluntary groups, worked through intermediary institutions. So you don't have that direct contact between citizen and, quote, big government. But government is still a very important part of the mix.
Still helping to fund that infrastructure that may not, the bureaucrat may not be standing at your door.
You know, I've mentioned funding, but it's also the legal system. It's also providing a legal architecture so that people can be pretty sure that the transaction they're making in the, quote, private sector is going to hold up. Or in the late 19th century, a whole series of court decisions that ensured trade could cross state lines. You know, states weren't always so happy about these large companies, these large corporations coming in and taking away jobs and selling products for things produced locally. And they created all kinds of barriers to that. And it was a conservative Supreme Court that said, no, 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 we need to have a national market. And they ran roughshod over what some people thought were basic states' rights in order to create that national market.
Interesting. We're talking with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. His most recent book is A Government Out of Sight. Brian, I find it really interesting, it seems, that both sides, the right and the left, the conservatives and the liberals, to some degree do subscribe to a notion of quote-unquote big government. They just define it differently. So a conservative might like the idea of a big government that gets involved in private medical decisions and says, no, you can't have that abortion, or the Terri Schiavo case, which to me was a great example of big government run roughshod over the private decisions of a family. And yet a lot of conservatives are fine with that.
Right, right. There's no question that, you know, we talk a lot about partisan rancor today, and there's no question that the parties are more ideologically pure than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And as you know, Coy, they're also more geographically lined up with a Republican base now in the South, a complete shift from 50 years ago. On the other hand, if you start examining the policies of the two parties as to the way they affect people's lives, and you don't just measure it in terms of the size of the budget or the number of federal personnel. Those are legitimate measures. But government affects our lives in so many other ways. You mentioned the Terri Schiavo case. You mentioned abortion. To introduce a little history into it, and maybe you don't want to talk about any more history, but this is 20th century history. You got to go back and look at all those socially conservative, largely Republicans in the early 20th century who were very strong supporters of first temperance and then national prohibition, right? It was one thing when states and localities enforced rules about drinking. We say states and localities do health and safety. That's a long tradition. But by the 1920s, you had the national government, and along with it, the growth of the FBI and enforcement of prohibition. And they were intruding directly into the homes and into the businesses of tens of thousands of Americans. Not the kind of thing you would expect conservatives to endorse.
But that was a huge conservative movement for decades in America.
Absolutely.
And I think Virginia went dry, 1912, 1913.
Yeah, and localities, of course, had been dry in Virginia forever.
Right, right.
Or at least since the early 19th century. And it kind of, in most states, it went locality by locality, and by late 19th, early 20th century, some states. But to have the whole national government imposing this regulation and what many saw as not just intrusion into their homes, but obviously intrusion into their livelihoods as well.
Sure. We're talking with Brian Ballow at the University of Virginia. What was the reaction to that? That national prohibition from, you know, folks who, whether in the middle or on the left, who saw this as, well, this is just big government run amok.
Well, I think what was, you know, the reaction certainly from the people who valued civil liberties, if we want to call that the left, and these things change, but I think that's a fair description. They were appalled. They pointed out the hypocrisy of this, the intrusion of the federal government, these folks into their lives. But what's really telling, Coy, is the reaction of those people in the middle and even on the right. As, you know, doors got busted down, as people were told what they could bring into their house, what they couldn't bring into the house, and as people actually began to see that if you're going to have prohibition, you're going to have a very visible, intrusive state, Americans really began to tire of prohibition greatly. On the other hand, it was not until the panic and then the Great Depression, followed by the New Deal, that Franklin Roosevelt was actually able to mount the political clout to repeal prohibition. It wasn't until the early 1930s, and part of the reason he did that, or part of the reason he gave, was something very relevant to us today, that's economic stimulus. Opening up the breweries, getting people back to work, this would create jobs. Consuming beers might encourage
people. And
that
trumped, those economic concerns trumped the social conservatives who were against drinking.
It did at that point in time. There were other factors going on. But, it's important to note that this regime of prohibition, of national prohibition, lasted for a long time, even though people understood there were cheaters, there were all kinds of ways to get around it. There were people,
huge black market.
Huge yeah. black market. And that's the other thing that Americans, again, in the middle and on the right, reacted to, the kind of corruption that seemed to accompany this very visible bureaucracy needed to enforce prohibition.
We're talking with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. We're going to continue this conversation after a break for local news and weather. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now. Let's rejoin our conversation with Brian Ballow, a professor of history at the University of Virginia, and he's one of the history guys at backstoryradio.org. You can check him out online, podcasts online, and you can also hear the program on National Public Radio. We're talking about the way we govern in America and how that has changed and evolved, and how some of these things that we debate today, we've always debated in America. They've always sort of been at the crux of the issues that sometimes divide us and sometimes bring us together. Let's, if we can, sort of fast forward to the two most recent administrations, the George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration, and get your thoughts about this theme of how we govern and how the federal government has acted under these administrations.
Well, I think it's a really good segue, Coy, because we've been talking about a lot of examples about day-to-day governance, delivering the mail, westward expansion, trade, the kinds of things that Americans need to do and turn to their government somewhat for on a day-to-day basis. But we fast forward to the last two administrations, and arguably we have two of the most important crises, certainly in the 20th century and now the 21st century. In the George W. Bush administration, we have 9/11 and the threat that terrorism poses. And of course, with Obama, the end of the Bush administration, I should say, and then the beginning of Obama administration, we have a fiscal crisis that is as serious as any that we've faced since the Great Depression. So what does that mean for governance? It means Americans, they abandon this more moderate attitude. Well, we want some government, but it has to operate somewhat out of sight. They say, hey, give me all the help I can get. And the best example of that is, of course, during the Great Depression, Roosevelt's programs of the New Deal. But maybe, I said the best example, maybe an even better example is the kind of very visible state that was built up during World War II, huge military force to win World War II, and then following World War II. Well, some of our younger listeners might say, well, yeah, what was the crisis? We won the war. It was a good war. It was great. Well, it was followed almost immediately by the Cold War. And that struggle, that twilight struggle, as some called it, against the Soviet Union, was really, many believed, an ideological fight to the death and a fight to the death of two very different systems. One, a liberal republic, albeit I would argue one that always turned to its national government, and one, a state-controlled command economy, which really was quite different. And Americans, you know, how did we end up paying so many taxes? How do we end up with bomb shelters? How do we end up with duck and cover? Well, Americans just didn't worry. They didn't sweat the details too much on all the things the national government did in the name of national security and keeping them safe. And the best example there is in the Republican Party, where we had before the war people like Robert Taft and even Arthur Vandenberg, a very prominent center before World War II, who tended towards isolationism, tended certainly towards a small military. After World War II, you know, give us protection. And this was epitomized in the modern Republican Party, pioneered by Barry Goldwater in many ways, who combined a libertarian sentiment, get government off our backs, you know, states' rights, leave things to states and localities, with very, very strong support for a very large military.
And of course, Barry Goldwater might get kicked out of the Republican Party today. They say, you're too liberal for us. Because he was, in many ways, a true libertarian when it came to some of those issues. He wouldn't pass the litmus test, in other words.
I don't know. I still think that the Republican Party includes, although they're in tension with often, other factions, it still includes many libertarians who would subscribe to most of what Barry Goldwater stood for.
Yeah. We're talking with Brian Ballow at the University of Virginia. And interesting, while you're talking, I was thinking of the many people might not know that in the 1930s, so much of America was just vehemently isolationist. And there were groups at the University of Virginia, of students at the University of Virginia, who would get together and promote isolationism. And they were very much against any type of involvement with the war in Europe, as they call it.
That's absolutely right. Although, again, for our listeners, and I know you know this, Coy, but we need to draw a distinction even there, because at the same time that those very isolationists were opposing military buildups or any kind of military treaties with foreign alliances, they were often very supportive of international trade. So they weren't so much for withdrawing from the world entirely. In fact, many of them promoted more trade with the world as a way of creating peace. But they were very much concerned about those entangling alliances. And that, of course, goes all the way back to Washington's farewell address.
Right. We're talking with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. If you got a question or a comment, it's 977-1070. So more of your thoughts about the two most recent administrations.
Yeah. So anyway, we got sidetracked here. This happens with historians.
It does. But and that's part of the fun.
No, it's not supposed to happen on radio. My producers on Backstory keep telling me that. No. So look, we have...
You're comfortable here. This is the land of tangents.
Oh,
so you are fine.
Hey, I love you, Coy. So we have two of the biggest crises in the last 50, maybe 75 years. So Bush's response is, you know, militarily, first Afghanistan and then Iraq, breaks for once and for all, perhaps, the, quote, Vietnam syndrome. You know, we're not going to get involved in foreign wars. It's not our business. Goes right through that barrier with great support from the American public, at least initially. But think about what happens at home. The largest reorganization of the executive branch of government since the creation of the Defense Department, since that World War II Cold War era, the Department of Homeland Security. It's a behemoth. And really, no complaints. Americans are happy to go along with this because they feel it will offer them security in a time of crisis. Then the fiscal crisis comes along, and it's already people are forgetting that this happened on Bush's watch. It didn't start with Obama.
Right.
And the big spending happened with Bush, too. He starts spending at a very, very accelerated rate for the TARP program and beginning to bail out those financial institutions in ways that couldn't have been imagined a year earlier than that, and has pretty strong political support for it. And then, of course, Obama has accelerated that pace of spending and has begun to receive a lot of criticism for it, but he's taking advantage of that political capital that he built up by winning the election and is off to really a pretty popular start, certainly individually, and, you know, has very good ratings about how he's handling the presidency, even though he's spending like gangbusters. Why is that? I think many Americans feel we're in a state of crisis, and they'd rather see the federal government spend a little bit more now, hopefully make the crisis a little shorter, a little shallower, than continue to be dragged down by the financial crisis. Of course, there are critics of that, and maybe we'll hear from some of them right now.
Is that the lesson of the Roosevelt era of the 1930s, the response of the federal government? I mean, are they – I know some of the folks that are involved in the decision-making with the response now are, quote-unquote, experts on that era. Are those the real takeaways from that era? Did it really take massive federal intervention to really get us out of the Depression?
In my opinion, it did. However – that massive federal intervention, as large as some of these New Deal spending programs were, that wasn't the massive fiscal intervention. The massive fiscal intervention was World War II. And in fact, when things looked a little better in 1937, Roosevelt started cutting back on some of his temporary programs, and the nation suffered what became known as the Roosevelt Recession. Unemployment certainly had not gone away, but it had dropped from maybe 22-25% down to 15%. You know, these are rough estimates because we didn't have the kind of data we have today. That is as of 37. So Roosevelt said, all right, you know, we need to be fiscally responsible. We'll cut back a little on spending. The economy went into the tank again. And that's when we got the Roosevelt Recession. And most.
Now, why did he cut back at that time?
He thought that things were turning around and people believed in general, as they do today, in fiscal responsibility and balanced budgets and only spending in the face of a crisis and not overheating the economy. So he began to cut back. He was also worried about the implications of long-term welfare. Roosevelt believed in equal opportunity. He believed that people getting jobs was ultimately the solution to economic problems. He was much more willing than Hoover, however, to use the authority of the national government in order to help people during a time of crisis. So when his advisors, and many of them were very fiscally conservative, people like Hans Morgenthau at the Treasury, when they felt that things were turning around, they throttled back and the economy went into the tank.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was Roosevelt, really, it was really World War II when we started ramping up for that. That's when things started turning around.
All the spending on the part of industry and
huge spending,
government investment, and jobs,
investment in new plant, all the kinds of things that we're talking about possibly doing today.
So Roosevelt wasn't the raging socialist that conservatives today try to make him out to be. It
no,
sounds like
he hardly was a raging socialist. In fact, there are many historians, I wouldn't go this far, but there are many historians who portray Roosevelt as being quite conservative and the guy who shored up capitalism, who tinkered, who made the reforms that made sure capitalism would survive throughout the 20th century. And that's what forestalled socialism in the United States.
It's quite ironic from what we hear from some folks, commentators today.
I suppose it depends what radio stations you listen to, Coy.
My guest is Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. His most recent book is A Government Out of Sight, The Mystery of National Authority in 19th Century America. He's also one of the history guys at backstoryradio.org. So if you had the ear, I'm curious, if you had the ear of President Obama today, knowing what you know about these about American history and these times when we have fallen into these periods of severe economic crisis. What is the advice? What should he be doing perhaps that he's not doing, and what should he do more of that he might be doing?
I think that's a great question. And besides first telling him to buy my book, I think I'd probably go on very humbly, because I think Obama has done a remarkably good job, and I'm an historian. I am not the politician that he is. But if you're asking what has history taught us, I think I would tell him that he has a lot of support for what he's doing because we are in a time of crisis, but he needs to think long term. And the kinds of programs that he needs to put in place are those that will ultimately rely on the private sector, rely on states and local governments, rely on voluntary organizations, from the Red Cross to religious groups, to disseminate, to kind of diffuse some of this national authority that right now he has no political problems pushing through, but ultimately that Americans turn to the national government somewhat, but they're very wary of visible centralized bureaucracy. And he'd
we're
say,
not comfortable with a sustained
that's right.
federal presence.
He'd say, so Ballow, exactly what are you talking about? And I'd say, well, let's take healthcare. I would advise him strongly to build on the existing system of employer-provided healthcare, a strong medical profession, lots of groups that really stand between the national government, even though the national government pays a lot of the bill, stand between the national government and the citizen, because I don't think in the long run Americans want a British-style state-run healthcare system. I might prefer that personally. I'm not talking about my personal preferences, but historically, I'd use this opportunity to fill in the remaining holes in the healthcare system without turning to a centralized state-run healthcare system.
We're talking with Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. Before I let you go, how do you think history will view George W. Bush's presidency? Two terms. Like every two-term president, perhaps the first was a little bit more successful than the second. For what your crystal ball is worth, what does it say?
Well, my crystal ball is not worth anything, Coy, so listeners be warned.
But you do know historians, and you know the profession.
I know this group of historians, but, you know, they change. I do not think that history will view the George W. Bush administration favorably. I think most importantly, they will conclude that he squandered a remarkable opportunity to bring the country together during the crisis in the immediate wake of 9/11. And he squandered that on what some might call flights of fancy in Iraq and what many would call a kind of return to partisan politics shortly after 9/11. Now, the Democrats, you know, they have to carry their share of the burden for that partisan squabbling as well. But as president and in the wake of a crisis, I think he had a really unique opportunity to bring the country together. And I think historians will conclude that he failed to take advantage of that opportunity. But there's good news for the Bush family, because I think the administration of his father is looking better all the time. So if you support the Bush family generally, it's good news and bad news.
Brian Ballow is a Mayo Distinguished Teaching Professor of History at the University of Virginia, and he serves as co-chair of the Governing America in a Global Era program at UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. His most recent book is A Government Out of Sight, and he's one of the history guys at backstoryradio.org. Brian, it's been an honor. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.